Да здравствует 60-я годовщина Великой Октябрьской социалистической революции! Да здравствует героический советский народ и его доблестные вооруженные силы! Слава Коммунистической партии Советского Союза, руководящей и направляющей силе советского общества! Ура!
Hello, brothers and sisters, back in the USSR on CFRU 93.3 FM. I'm Siegfried. As of the time of recording, it is March 8th, International Women's Day, the date that also marks the start of the February Revolution of 1917, spearheaded by the working class women of Petrograd, who toppled the Tsar and effectively initiated the revolutionary process that would culminate in Red October. So solidarity with the sisters out there all around the world who continue to fight for dignity and equality in their homes, their workplaces, and society in general. Of course, I talked about the current imperialist war against Iran last week, and there are numerous reactionary rogues and scoundrels, some of whom claim to be Iranian, who would have you believe that this war of aggression, which slaughters school girls in their classrooms and has killed over 1,000 civilians across Iran, is somehow in defense of Iranian women. They said the same thing about Iraq and Afghanistan, and they were lying through their teeth back then too. Women did not benefit from the wholesale destruction of those two countries. Women's lives were destroyed, completely torn apart, by those invasions by the forces of American empire. There was no liberation. Imperialism does not liberate. It either exploits what it can take or destroys what it can't take. And Trump, Netanyahu, and the Epstein class have made it very clear that they want to destroy Iran in its entirety. So for a reality check, I'd like to quote Carlos Martinez, a brilliant author and anti-imperialist based in the UK, and his greetings for International Women's Day 2026. So here we go. Happy International Women's Day. 9 days into a brutal and criminal war being waged by Israel and the U.S. against Iran, our foremost duty today is to stand in solidarity with Iranian women who are courageously resisting Zionist and imperialist aggression, facing bombs, missiles, and threats with dignity and heroism. Of course, the liberal justification for this war is based on the supposed suffering of women in Iran. We liberate women by bombing girls' schools. Plus la chance, plus la même chose, right? Colonialists and Zionists have always claimed a profoundly racist, civilizing mission to justify their crimes, as indeed did Nazi Germany. France used the alleged oppression of women in Islamic society to justify its despicable colonial occupation of Algeria. Iranian women are defending their country and standing up for their sovereignty. The elders among them will remember when, under the modern Shah's dictatorship, female literacy stood at below 30%. Very few women were able to go to university, and very few women had the opportunity to engage in meaningful work. Today, in a supposed theocracy, female literacy is close to 100%. 100% in Iran today. Women constitute a majority in higher education, and 40% of doctors are female. Women are involved in government, business, education, healthcare, culture, sport, etc. Hijab or no hijab, Iranian women have achieved remarkable progress within the framework of the Islamic Republic, compared to where they were in 1979. Meanwhile, in the West, the media villainizes Iran as an oppressive society while ignoring the spiraling crisis of violent misogyny and reactionary patriarchal thinking at home. Let's not play their game. Stand with the women of Iran, of Gaza, of Lebanon, of Cuba, of Venezuela. To all women around the world facing imperialist aggression, we are with you. That's Carlos Martinez. Of course, Iran has been fighting back. I talked about last week how they started immediately hitting U.S. bases throughout West Asia with their missiles in response to the brutal and unprovoked attack of February 28th, when the U.S. and Israel tried to decapitate the entire Iranian government in one blow. Since then, the mainstream news has gotten pretty quiet. And that's because Iran has been devastating American assets in the region. That's military bases, CIA stations, you name it. Fleet replenishment, naval yards, and just hammering apartheid Israel harder than ever before. Air defenses are being depleted, and the only real response from the U.S. and Israel has been to devastate civilian areas of Tehran and other Iranian cities to try to scare the Iranian people into surrender. And it isn't working. Iran is standing strong, and the mask is falling off the U.S. and Israel, even as the mainstream media runs damage control. And you want to go to Ben Norton's latest report about the war, Ben Norton of Geopolitical Economy Report. His report talks about the dirty tricks that the U.S. and Israel have tried to use and how they're bombing multiple countries now, not just Iran, in their desperation to maintain their brutal empire. Please stay tuned to Back in the USSR.
The war that the United States and Israel initiated against Iran is spreading. More and more countries are getting involved, not only in the Middle East, but in other regions of the world. And the U.S. and Israel are attacking more and more countries. Well, Donald Trump is now even threatening longtime U.S. allies in Europe. What we're seeing right now is a situation of chaos, and it's getting worse and worse as the U.S. government tries to solve every political issue with more bombs and bullets. So as the U.S. and Israel have been bombing Iran, Iran has been retaliating in self-defense, which it is allowed to do under international law, and Iran has been hitting U.S. military bases in many countries surrounding it in the Middle East, in West Asia. Meanwhile, the global price of oil has been skyrocketing because Iran has vowed to shut down the Strait of Hormuz, which is the most important oil transit choke point on Earth. Every single day, one-fifth, more than 20% of the global oil supply travels through this very narrow strait, and it's right off the coast of Iran, and Tehran has vowed to shut down this strait in response to the U.S.-Israeli war. At the same time, the State Department has ordered U.S. citizens to evacuate all of the countries of the region, including Bahrain, Egypt, Iran, Iraq, Israel, occupied Palestine, Jordan, Kuwait, Lebanon, Oman, Qatar, Saudi Arabia, Syria, the United Arab Emirates, and Yemen. And yet, at the same time, the U.S. State Department is not actually providing any support for Americans who are trying to flee these countries. It's a situation of extreme chaos. But instead of trying to stabilize the situation, you know what Donald Trump is doing? He's threatening to pour fuel on the fire, and now the U.S. government is making plans to arm Kurdish groups, fighters, not only in Iran, but also in Iraq, to wage a war on the ground instead of sending U.S. troops. CNN reported that the CIA is working to arm Kurdish forces to spark an uprising in Iran. And according to CNN, the U.S. strategy is not only to arm these Kurdish mercenaries in northwestern Iran, but also in northeastern Iraq. So the U.S. wants them to invade Iran from across the Iraqi border. This could spread the war even further because this is very likely going to worry Turkey, a NATO member, which is constantly playing the West against the East, playing both sides. Turkey is deathly afraid of Kurdish armed groups because for decades there have been Kurdish armed groups operating in southeastern Turkey. So as the CIA prepares an invasion of Iran by arming these Kurdish militants, Turkey may also start attacking these Kurdish groups in Iraq, in Iran, in Turkey, maybe even in Syria, because the U.S. was previously backing armed Kurdish groups in Syria to try to overthrow the Syrian government, which the U.S. did succeed in. So the U.S. is now threatening to expand this war further by potentially dragging in Turkey, which has the second largest military in NATO after the U.S. itself. The situation is absolutely crazy. But it has been reported now by multiple Western media outlets that Trump is calling leaders of Kurdish armed groups in Iraq and preparing to invade Iran to open another front in this war against Iran. And all this is deeply ironic because Trump was elected on the promise that he would be a so-called peace president and he would not wage any more wars. But Trump has been openly saying that this war that the U.S. is waging against Iran, an illegal war of aggression, could go on for several weeks or far longer, he said. But in the meantime, this war is getting larger and larger by the day because Israel is also expanding this war. Israel has now invaded Lebanon, and what Israel is now trying to do is reoccupy southern Lebanon. Back in 1982, Israel invaded South Lebanon and occupied the area for nearly two decades until 2000, when indigenous resistance groups inside Lebanon expelled the Israeli occupiers. Well, now Israel is taking advantage of this regional war to reoccupy southern Lebanon, opening another front in this growing international war. But that's not all, because Israel is likewise using this war against Iran to open up another war, which is the war on Gaza. Israel has once again started its siege of Gaza, trying to starve the Palestinian people, denying them food and supplies, as Israel prepares to annex Gaza and more Palestinian territory. But what's even crazier is that's not all, because at the same time, the U.S. is attacking several other countries. For instance, Reuters reported that U.S. Marines are now shooting protesters in Pakistan, in the Pakistani city of Karachi. And the U.S. has started another war in Latin America, on the other side of the world. U.S. Southern Command, which oversees U.S. military operations in Latin America, announced that U.S. military forces have launched operations in Ecuador in South America. So while Trump is waging war on Iran, an illegal war of aggression, and as Iran is retaliating and hitting U.S. bases in a dozen countries in the region, and while Israel is imposing another siege of Gaza and invading Lebanon, the U.S. decided, hey, this is a great time to start a war in Ecuador as well. And keep in mind that this is at a time when the U.S. is also basically waging a war on Cuba. The New York Times admitted that the U.S. military is carrying out a naval blockade of Cuba to strangle the country, denying Cuba oil, preventing it from importing any oil, to starve the country of the supplies it needs to try to collapse the economy to overthrow Cuba's revolutionary government. That is still happening during this war. As the U.S. is waging war on Iran, the U.S. military is also making sure that no oil can be sent to Cuba. In fact, Bloomberg reported that Russia tried to send a tanker of oil to Cuba, but the U.S. forced the Russian tanker to turn away to try to suffocate and collapse Cuban society. So again, to clarify all this madness that's happening right now, the U.S. and Israel launched an illegal war of aggression against Iran, which continues to escalate. Iran has hit multiple countries in the region targeting U.S. military bases, which are in basically every other country in the region. Israel has invaded Lebanon and is blockading Gaza yet again. The CIA is working with Kurdish groups in Iraq to invade Iran from Iraq, which could potentially draw Turkey into an even bigger regional war. And the U.S. military is shooting protesters in Pakistan, and the U.S. military started another war in Ecuador. And in January, Trump invaded Venezuela and kidnapped Venezuela's president, Nicolas Maduro. And Trump is now trying to suffocate Cuba with a naval blockade of Cuba. And this is all being done by a guy who calls himself the peace president. Again, Trump campaigned promising that he would end U.S. wars and he would be a peacemaker.
My proudest legacy will be that of a peacemaker and unifier. That's what I want to be, a peacemaker and a unifier. But we had no wars. They said, he will start a war. I'm not going to start a war. I'm going to stop wars.
Just a few weeks ago, Trump launched an organization that he calls the Board of Peace, which in reality was an attempt by the U.S. to replace the United Nations with a privatized pro-war organization that only the U.S. can control. But all this is totally crazy and Orwellian. Trump now has the world record for bombing more countries than any other U.S. president. And I'm not trying to absolve other U.S. presidents. All presidents in the modern history of the U.S. have been war criminals who have carried out illegal wars of aggression abroad. If you look at the past four presidents in the past 25 years, since 2001, that's George W. Bush, Barack Obama, Trump, and Joe Biden. Together, these presidents have waged war on 10 countries. Trump is the only one who has attacked all 10 countries when you combine his first and second terms. In 2025 alone, the first year of his presidency, Trump bombed 7 countries, and now we can also add Ecuador. So Trump has attacked 11 countries in his 2 terms as president, including Afghanistan, Iraq, Yemen, Pakistan, Somalia, Libya, Syria, Venezuela, Nigeria, Iran, and now Ecuador. And he has 3 more years, so who knows how many more countries he's going to attack in the next few years. And by the way, while all this is happening, Trump is also threatening to attack longtime U.S. allies, including Spain, a member of the European Union. Because Spain has really been a thorn in the side of the U.S. empire in the past few years. Spain currently has a left-wing government led by the Spanish Socialist Workers Party, and the left-wing government of Spain has been the only country in the EU that has been openly opposing Trump's illegal war of aggression against Iran. Trump has been demanding that countries in Europe let the US military use their bases in order to attack Iran, and the UK is allowing the US to use its military bases. However, Spain is not. The Spanish government has told the US that it cannot use Spanish military bases in order to launch strikes on Iran, and the Spanish government has condemned this war, saying that it's illegal and violates international law, which is objectively true, by the way. So you know what Trump's response has been? He's now threatening to attack Spain. Listen to the following remarks in the White House when Trump was holding a press briefing with the leader of Germany sitting right next to him, another member of the EU. And by the way, I'll talk about Germany's Chancellor Friedrich Merz, who's a right-wing US puppet. He totally went along with this, and he also threatened Spain. But listen to these comments here, where Trump threatens to, one, impose an embargo on Spain to cut off all trade between Spain and the US as a form of economic warfare to force Spain to allow the US to use its military bases to attack Iran. That was the first part of Trump's threat. But then secondly, he also says that the US can simply invade Spain, attack Spain, and forcibly take over its military bases in order to attack Iran. This is an absolutely crazy comment made by the US president in the White House sitting next to the German leader threatening so-called ally Spain, a fellow EU member. Listen to these crazy remarks.
Well, some of the European nations have been helpful and some haven't. And I'm, you know, very surprised. Germany's been great. He's been terrific. Others have been very good, terrific. I think that the head of NATO, Mark, is fantastic. Okay.
Is.
Mark Rutte. I think he's fantastic. But some of the European, like Spain, has been terrible. In fact, I told Scott to cut off all dealings with Spain. Spain, first of all, it started when every European nation, at my request, paid 5%, which they should be doing. And everybody was enthusiastic about it, Germany, everybody. And Spain didn't do it. And now Spain actually said that we can't use their bases. And that's all right. We could use their base if we want. We could just fly in and use it. Nobody's going to tell us not to use it. But we don't have to. But they were unfriendly. And so I told him, we don't want to. Spain has absolutely nothing that we need other than great people. They have great people, but they don't have great leadership. And as you know, they were the only country that in NATO would not agree to go up to 5%. I don't think they wanted agreed to go up to anything. They wanted to keep it at 2%, and they don't pay the 2%. So we're going to cut off all trade with Spain. We don't want anything to do with Spain.
Note how Trump there was threatening to invade Spain, a so-called Western ally, a member of NATO and the EU. This is what Trump said. These are the exact remarks. Spain, quote, said that we can't use their base, and that's all right. We don't need to. We could use their base if we want. We could just fly in and use it. Nobody's going to tell us not to use it, end quote. When he says fly in and use it, he means the US military will invade Spain, at least their bases, and take over their bases. This is absolutely insane. And then on top of that, Trump said that he ordered the Treasury Secretary, the billionaire hedge fund manager from Wall Street, Scott Bessent, to cut off all trade with Spain, to impose an embargo on Spain. And one of Trump's big complaints there is that the left-wing government of Spain opposes the extreme militarism of the U.S. and most of the European countries, which have announced they're going to more than double their military spending from 2% of GDP to 5% of GDP. And the Spanish government said, no, we should be spending more on social programs and healthcare and education and civilian infrastructure, not weapons and military infrastructure. But this is infuriating the U.S. government and the U.S. military industrial complex, which, of course, all these U.S. corporations want to profit from selling more weapons and military equipment to European members of NATO. But I actually think it's about even more than just that. I think Trump is also trying to punish Spain because Spain has been one of the very few European countries that not only opposes the illegal U.S. war of aggression against Iran, but also has openly supported Palestine. In 2024, Spain officially recognized Palestine as a state, along with Ireland. You know, Ireland has a history of resisting British colonialism. So Ireland has often been one of the very few countries in Europe that has sometimes opposed Western imperialism. Not always, but on the issue of Palestine, Ireland has often been quite good. And also Norway, surprisingly, also recognized the state of Palestine. But Spain has also gone further. And in October 2025, the left-wing parties in the Spanish parliament formally approved an arms embargo against Israel. The right-wing pro-US parties voted against this law because they support Israel, but the left-wing parties approved this measure to ban the shipment of any weapons to Israel in solidarity with Palestine. And Spain's Prime Minister Pedro Sanchez also criticized Israel for, quote, exterminating a defenseless people, end quote, by bombing hospitals in Gaza and, quote, killing innocent boys and girls with hunger, end quote. And by the way, while all this is happening, Spain has also been pushing for closer ties with China, which has really infuriated Washington because the political forces inside Europe are split. Most leaders in Europe are very Atlanticist, very pro-US, but Spain, the left-wing government in Spain, has been a bit more independent and has been trying to diversify its foreign relations and improve relations with China. And in fact, the media outlet Global Times, the major Chinese newspaper, referred to Chinese-Spanish relations as a model of international interaction and has encouraged other countries in Europe to follow this model. So all of this explains why the Trump administration is so furious with the Spanish government and why Trump is now threatening to attack Spain and impose a trade embargo against Spain after Madrid refused to allow the U.S. military to use its bases to attack Iran. However, with all of that said, I mentioned that Europe is internally very much divided politically, and among the major European countries, one of the most pro-U.S. governments is the right-wing government of Germany, led by the multimillionaire Friedrich Merz, who obediently does whatever Trump wants. And I mentioned that Trump made these comments threatening Spain while he was sitting in the White House in a press briefing right next to the leader of Germany, Chancellor Merz. So listen to these comments here where a journalist asks Merz, okay, Trump just threatened Spain. Do you support the idea of punishing Spain? And you know what the German leader's response was? Yes, we do support punishing Spain. He conveniently did not mention anything about the war in Iran, even though publicly the German government has endorsed the illegal U.S.-Israeli war of aggression against Iran. Merz personally supports this war of aggression. He didn't mention that in his comments here. Instead, he said Spain should be punished because it refuses to more than double its military spending from 2% of GDP to 5% of GDP.
Chancellor Merz, you just heard that the president is thinking about punishing Spain. What are your thoughts, what can you do on this, and what can you do to...
the answer on that is quite simple. We are trying to convince Spain to catch up with the 3% or 3.5%, which we agree on in NATO. And as the president said, it's correct. Spain is the only one who is not willing to accept that. And we are trying to convince them that this is a part of our common security that we all have to comply with this numbers, and this is 3.5 for military and another 1.5 for our military infrastructure. So Spain has to comply with that.
So what that perfectly illustrates is how the idea of European solidarity is a total myth. The idea of European unity is a total myth. Germany is publicly allying itself with the US to threaten a fellow EU country because they refuse to support an imperial war of aggression against Iran in violation of international law, and because they refuse to more than double their military spending to prepare for even more wars. And don't forget who exactly Friedrich Merz is. The reason he's such a diehard Atlanticist, he's so pro-US, is because he is a multimillionaire from Wall Street. He was previously the head of the German arm of BlackRock, the extremely powerful Wall Street investment firm, the largest asset manager on earth. And given his work with Wall Street financial firms, Merz has become very wealthy. He's a multimillionaire who owns two private jets. I repeat, two private jets. So it's no wonder that he supports whatever the US government wants, because his class interests lie with Wall Street, not the people of Germany, not the people of Europe. He is a capitalist oligarch who is only following his economic interests, which happen to go against the interests of his country. So now that the leader of the United States is publicly threatening a trade embargo against Spain and potentially threatening to even invade Spain to take over its military bases, I was reminded of a famous quote from the late US imperial strategist and war criminal Henry Kissinger, who famously said that, quote, "It may be dangerous to be America's enemy, but to be America's friend is fatal," end quote. And the last thing that I'll add here before I conclude is that I think Trump's threats against Spain have actually worried other European countries, because previously, most European countries openly supported this illegal US war of aggression against Iran. But now, after Trump's threats against Spain, some European leaders are taking one step back. They're still supporting the war, but they're now admitting that this is an illegal war. For instance, France's president, Emmanuel Macron, acknowledged that the US and Israeli strikes against Iran, the so-called preemptive strikes, were illegal. They violated international law. Although at the same time, I should emphasize, Macron, the multimillionaire banker, another oligarch, he also said that he still supports the war and he still supports attacking Iran and trying to overthrow Iran's government. His criticism was very minor and procedural. And he said, yes, technically, this violates international law. And he said we should respect international law, which is extremely hypocritical. Because just a few hours before releasing that statement, the governments of Germany, France, and the UK released a joint statement announcing that they are joining this war. Not only do they support it, they are joining it. So this is like the most fake opposition that a political leader could ever pretend to engage in. Macron at one moment is saying, yeah, we are participating in this war. We are helping to wage this war. And then in the next moment, they say, this war is illegal. It violates international law. But the only logical conclusion you can come from this is that France doesn't actually care that it violates international law because they're joining the illegal war. I mean, it's just crazy. And these European leaders keep showing themselves to be total vassals of the US empire, because while they're publicly praising the US and supporting this war, Trump is continuing to attack multiple European countries. So in that press conference where he threatened Spain, Trump also criticized the UK and British Prime Minister Keir Starmer, claiming falsely that supposedly the UK is not letting the US use its military bases to attack Iran.
Spain has been very, very uncooperative, and so has UK. Now, the second one is shocking, but this is not the age of Churchill.
But then Keir Starmer came out publicly and said, no, actually, we are allowing the US to use our bases to attack Iran. So the UK is directly engaged in this war of aggression. even while Trump is criticizing Keir Starmer. I mean, Trump himself is obviously crazy and completely unhinged, but these European leaders are also complete cowards and vassals who, as Trump attacks them, they just keep saying, "Yes, Emperor, yes, Daddy Trump," as the NATO leader Mark Rutte, the right-wing former prime minister of the Netherlands, Mark Rutte literally called Donald Trump Daddy.
And then Daddy has to sometimes use strong language.
You have to use strong language. Every once in a while, you have to use a certain word.
Mark Rutte, the NATO chief, who is your friend, he called you Daddy earlier. Do you regard your NATO allies as kind of children?
No, he likes me. I think he likes me. If he doesn't, I'll let you know. I'll come back and I'll hit him hard, okay? No.
But do you
he did.
Regard...
He did it very affectionately. He, Daddy, you're my daddy.
So they're all saying, yes, Daddy, yes, Emperor Trump, we will do whatever you want. And I have to say that Canada is doing the exact same thing. Clearly, the Canadian government is coordinating with Western European governments because Canada's Liberal Prime Minister Mark Carney initially came out and openly said that Canada supports this U.S. war of aggression against Iran. But then many people came out and criticized Carney, pointing out that he was totally contradictory and hypocritical because just a few weeks before, the Canadian Prime Minister gave a widely applauded speech at the World Economic Forum in Davos, in which he declared that the rules-based international order was being destroyed by the unilateralism of Trump and the U.S., and he claimed that Canada would work together with other middle powers in order to defend the so-called rules-based order. That was obviously extremely hypocritical, so immediately after Canada endorsed this U.S. war of aggression against Iran, he published another statement admitting that, quote, "the current conflict is another example of the failure of the international order." Now the United States and Israel have acted without engaging the United Nations or consulting with allies. We implore all parties, including the United States and Israel, to respect the rules of international engagement, end quote. So in other words, Carney was admitting that this is a war of aggression. It does violate international law. But in the exact same statement, he still made it clear that Canada supports attacking Iran. Again, the hypocrisy is incredible. He condemned the strikes carried out by Iran, even though Iran has a right under international law to self-defense. And he claimed that Iran is the principal source of instability in the Middle East, not the U.S. and Israel, Iran. He said, "We support efforts to prevent Iran from obtaining a nuclear weapon," and said, quote, "Canada has long supported the imperative of neutralizing this grave global threat," end quote. So once again, we see how these Western countries that, after immediately endorsing this illegal war of aggression against Iran, they're now taking one step back, but they're still saying they support the war, and they're still blaming everything on Iran, which is completely ridiculous. Because in 2015, Iran signed the nuclear deal, the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, the JCPOA, along with the US and other Western countries and China and Russia. And Iran was abiding by that agreement, according to the International Atomic Energy Agency, the IAEA. But it was the US, under Trump in his first term, that illegally withdrew from the nuclear deal and put us on this path toward war. It is the US empire that is responsible for this war. And then last year in 2025, when Iran participated in so-called peace talks in what it thought were negotiations to come to another nuclear deal with the US government, what happened? Trump used those as cover in order to launch a surprise war against Iran, the so-called 12-day war, destroying the negotiations. And the exact same thing happened this February when Iran was willing to negotiate another nuclear deal, and the US and Israel once again sabotaged those peace talks and launched another war of aggression against Iran. If you want more information about that context and that very important history, we have another video about that issue. I will link to that in the description below. On that note, I'm going to conclude. I am Ben Norton. I am the editor-in-chief of Geopolitical Economy Report. I want to thank everyone for joining me today. Please like and subscribe. Please share this. I will see you all next time.
Here comes the helicopter, second time today. Everybody scatters and hopes it goes away. How many kids they've murdered, only God can say. Don't believe in dark borders, and I don't believe in hate. I don't believe in generals or their stinking torture states. And when I talk with the survivors of things too sickening. Or some less humane fate.
You're listening to Back in the USSR here on 93.3 FM CFRU. I am Siegfried, and that was Bruce Coburn. If I had a rocket launcher. A lot of rocket launchers are being used right now by the people of Lebanon as they fight back against the brutal Israeli onslaught, which never really stopped after the supposed ceasefire. Just like the bombs never stopped falling on Gaza after the supposed ceasefire. And they're fighting back just like the Iranian people are fighting back against this brutal aggression. You know, basically by the collective West at this point. You know, by all these countries, European countries included. You know, and by the U.S., of course, and Israel. Now, I want to conclude. I mean, of course, we had Ben Norton's report there about the widening war in West Asia. But I want to end things tonight with a very, very amazing tribute, very strong tribute to the late Michael Parenti. Of course, I've played so many of his excerpts, his clips on this show, and drawn so much inspiration from him, and interviewed him myself even back in 2011. But this tribute by Gabriel Rockhill, who's an amazing Marxist scholar, analyst, recently came out with a book, Who Paid the Pipers of Western Marxism, about how the CIA basically manufactured a supposedly radical academic left in the context of the Cold War to try to basically suppress actual Marxism and actual communism. An amazing book, which I urge you all to check out. But his tribute was just amazing in a recent conference we did with Carlos Martinez and several other guests in a live stream. So I want to play that. I was going to play that last week, but I'm going to play it now. Please stay tuned to Back in the USSR and solidarity, comrades and friends.
Thank you so much, Carlos, and thank you to all of the other organizers and the other panelists. So history is a major site of class struggle. Now that Parenti has officially entered history, it is imperative that we carry his legacy forward by lifting him up as a figure who towers over the compatible left intelligentsia, promoted by the imperial superstructure, as a few other speakers have already mentioned. If it be Noam Chomsky, Slavoj Žižek, Michael Hart, Antonio Negri, or others of his of their ilk. Michael Parenti was not only one of the greatest thinkers, writers, and educators of his generation, he also maintained the red thread through some of the darkest years of anti-communist revanchism in the belly of the beast. By the red thread, I mean our connection to the wealth of collective, theoretical, and practical knowledge available in the global tradition of dialectical and historical materialism. From a working class background, he quickly matured beyond the progressive liberal framework on offer, which serves to contain the left, through a humble project of self-critique, fueled in part by his direct involvement in the anti-imperialist struggle against the U.S. war on Vietnamese sovereignty. Breaking out of the ideological encasements predominant at the time, including certain tendencies in the new left to supplant class struggle by culture wars, he undertook an expansive project of political education, writing dozens of magisterial works and providing brilliant lectures and interviews. I don't think it is an exaggeration to say that he has been one of the single greatest educational resources of his generation. This is most certainly the case in the belly of the beast, where the intelligentsia's level of political consciousness tends to be significantly limited by imperial indoctrination, but his reach extends around the world. The breadth of Parenti's work needs to be highlighted since he was invested in analysis of the social totality. Some of his best known work, at least within activist circles, focuses on the real material history of actually existing socialism, which forcefully pushes back against so many of the myths and lies, as in his classic Black Shirts and Reds. His critical diagnoses of what he calls democracy for the few in the United States, and all of his insightful critiques of US-led imperialism, provide some of the best accounts of the settler colony that became the world's leading imperialist power. He also examined in detail some of the major imperialist endeavors and their consequences, as in his major work on the NATO intervention in Yugoslavia and his excellent late essay on Ukraine. These works are not often referenced in academic settings, at least in my experience, and they've had a lasting impact on the broader world. His reach extends well beyond the themes that I've just mentioned, however, since he is also one of the most insightful media critics, and he's published some of the most important works on cultural class struggle, media manipulation, and propaganda. He has also engaged deeply with questions of historical methodology and the political stakes of history, as in History is Mystery, and he even wrote a fascinating history of Caesar and ancient Rome, as Ali mentioned earlier. The breadth of Parenti's engagements is seconded by their depth, and he has proven himself to be one of the most reliable scholars due to his diligent analysis of sources and the rigor of his research. At the same time, he is one of the clearest and most straightforward writers whose books are capable of reaching and educating a mass audience. There's much more that could be said about his project as a whole, but in the interest of time, I'd simply like to highlight a few more specific aspects of his contributions. The first is that form matters. Above and beyond all of the content that Parenti produced, he also modeled for us modes of political education that truly bring people in. Part of this was surely due to his humility, integrity, and warmth as a person, which clearly comes through in his lectures and interviews. However, he also obviously cultivated his communicative skills as an art form. His prose is poetic, without being pretentious. It is straightforward, but never overly simplistic. It brings the reader in and educates them rather than turning them off through unnecessary performances of intellectual superiority. His oral communication provides us with the complete range of human experience, leaving the listener with much more than just the content of what he's teaching. It models for us and makes us feel righteous anger at injustice, the fierce resolve necessary to stand strong against opposition, but also the humility and open-mindedness of someone invested in lifelong learning and who understands that the primary struggle is to change the world and that we have to do this together. His seriousness, though, is always combined with humor, and he can deftly move his audience from anger to laughter, from rage to mirth. He was, in short, a master communicator and a magisterial, as he says himself, raconteur. One of the many themes that I've been impressed by is his diagnosis of what he calls the gangster state, which provides an essential framework for understanding the imperial bourgeois state and elucidating the current conjuncture. Parenti developed this analysis in relation to the debate surrounding the assassination of John F. Kennedy. He rejected the dominant ideological position among major segments of the intelligentsia, including the once towering compatible left figure of Noam Chomsky, which was that it was conspiratorial to undertake a materialist examination of the evidence suggesting that the state narrative regarding the killing was hiding more than it was revealing. Parenti reminded everyone that the idea that groups of people would conspire to advance their own interests is readily admitted for many sectors of society. To take but one example, it was maintained for decades that there was a Judeo-Bolshevik or communist conspiracy to destroy Western civilization, something that is now coming back into vogue, particularly if you listen to Marco Rubio's recent presentation in Munich. The idea that there would be conspiracies in the sense of a group of people conspiring to advance their interests is thus clearly not the problem. The issue is really whether it is acceptable to engage in a materialist analysis of the ruling class and its state managers when they conspire to advance their interests. This is what is verboten. Parenti reminds us, quote, "Often the term conspiracy is applied dismissively whenever one suggests that people who occupy positions of political and economic power are consciously dedicated to advancing their elite interests. Even when they openly profess their designs, there are those who deny that intent is involved." Fearlessly rejecting these external, ideologically motivated limits placed on a materialist analysis of the social totality, Parenti investigated the evidence surrounding the Kennedy assassination and highlighted facts like the following. 80% of scholarly books at the time on the Kennedy assassination attributed it to a conspiracy involving intelligence agencies. 40 people who had information related to the assassination met violent deaths in the wake of the Kennedy assassination. In Hunt versus Liberty Lobby, a U.S. court of law found that, quote, "President Kennedy had indeed been murdered by a conspiracy involving, in part, CIA operatives E. Howard Hunt and Frank Sturgis and FBI informant Jack Ruby," end quote. We can draw one clear lesson from this. Yes, the ruling class and its managers conspire to advance their interests, and they besmirch intellectuals who reveal this fact as psychologically disturbed and quote-unquote conspiratorial in their thinking in an effort to kill the messenger so the message doesn't get across. In other words, the ruling class and their managers conspire to label as conspiratorial researchers who reveal the material reality of their own conspiratorial activity. Another theme, and I'm arriving at the end of my comments in Parenti's work, that I'd like to emphasize in the current conjuncture is his analysis of media manipulation. He provides one of the most concise and insightful overviews of the propaganda tools used to indoctrinate us. I'd refer everyone, if they haven't read it, to the excellent and very short essay entitled Methods of Media Manipulation that was recollected in Contrary Notions. He highlights there a number of key tactics: suppression by omission, when the media simply leaves out certain fundamental stories; attack and destroy the target as soon as a journalist or an intellectual reveals something important, they try to destroy the messenger, as they did in the case of Gary Webb, who was essential to breaking some of the story of the CIA involvement in trafficking drugs from Latin America through the United States. Labeling, meaning the use of certain terms in order to communicate at an implicit level things that are helpful to the advancement of empire, like the term extraordinary rendition instead of international illegal kidnapping, de torture, and often assassination. Taking it as a given, meaning how the media simply accepts certain narratives or certain orientations without even questioning them, which goes hand in hand with what he calls face value transmission, when the press serves as stenographers of power and simply reference things like American interests, the world community, and other such things. Repetition and normalization is, of course, very key, and we're all familiar with that. But also there's the slighting of content, meaning that there's an attempt to superficially reference elements that are at the limits of the dominant spectrum to create the illusion that there's an inclusive kind of balancing of perspectives, while ultimately always centering the more conservative-leaning, pro-imperialist, pro-capitalist orientations, as well as follow-up avoidance. So anytime anyone is able to puncture the kind of media complex, they're either cut off, slandered, made secondary, or, as we see very clearly in the Epstein revelations, they engage in the project of a limited hangout. They want to make it all about the villainous figure of Epstein and not ask essential questions like, who was Epstein working for and with? What are these people continuing to do? And how did the international pedophilia ring relate to all of the illegal activities they're engaged in with international criminal syndicates, with intelligence networks, with financial interests, and a whole series of other illegal activities on the part of the gangster imperialist states? These are the issues that we need to be pursuing instead of simply taking the limited hangout by the propaganda apparatus and running with it. Much more could be said, but I'd like to conclude by asserting that Parenti has made a fundamental contribution to the international project of liberation. He shall forever rest in power as a source of inspiration, a model of integrity, a magisterial educator, and a humble servant of what we might refer to as the anti-communist cause. Thank you.
I'm Michael Hudson. I'm appearing here for the International Manifesto Group. If you like this video and ones like it, please subscribe. For more information, go to the address on the screen.